Blog Talk Radio.
Effects. It's an absolute pleasure to have you here. 13th of December, 6015 Anno Lumine. Happens to be the 347th day of the year. Hard to believe, isn't it? That only leaves us with 18 days left for the end of the year. Remember, in the finest of pagan ritual, pagan being a propaganda term of the Christian movement to try and, you know, fill in the ranks. The first day of winter begins on the 21st of December. So I expect all of these wonderful Freemason types to be out there at 11:48 p.m., just to shortly before midnight, 12 minutes before midnight on the 21st, looking up at the heavens, celebrating the awe that is the universe and the small speck, and appreciating the small speck in that floating mass that is our world, and then perhaps the insignificance, the ridiculousness of our existence will become apparent. We are such a little bag of water and molecules, yeah, atoms. It's a humbling and enriching experience just to be able to put ourselves in a frame of mind where we have a sense of belonging to all of that. All of that. I'm still tempted here as we come up to Christmas. It's very tempting to start off the conversations, and I'm going to be doing that soon. I'll be in conversation with various Masons that I'll select that I think will have something to contribute to our understanding of the craft and the order, always building on the understanding of the craft as if it's a task incomplete, is really a pastiche. It's a matter of us accomplishing that task of trying to understand our nature. It's not an organization. We can draft that out, and my goodness knows enough effort has been done to draft and redraft and refine year after year ad nauseum. The work is excellent, but we can. The one thing that I think we might want to consider is whether we ever feel that the work is good enough, that the work is complete. Our Grand Master is doing he's doing a hell of a job. And he had great expectations on his shoulders, and he's prepared. I like to think that he's prepared all his life for this this time, and I think he's bringing he's brought his A game. So hear, sir. Hear, Grand Master. Anyway, I want to talk to you about some things classic. And I hope you're all in some way feeling that you may be part of this this narrative about conservative masonry. I think that it is possible to to change without making innovation, which I think is part of the instruction that part of the legacy that we've been given, and feel very. Is a very essential part of masonry. But why the classical endures? I want to talk to you. We need to talk about this a little bit. I hope that you've come to terms with the sense that Freemasonry isn't really about expressing ego. It's not about digging heels into the face of the earth wherever you go so that so that your marks are left. We're stewards of the land. We don't own it. We have no business attempting to damage it. And my goodness, the ego out of 7 billion of us, are we that shallow that we have to compete? We have an opportunity to achieve an harmonic. And as long as we have that sense that we're competing, it's not about the competition. It's who is the competition directed toward. Well, in Freemasonry, we compete within ourselves. And I think that we compete the way the painter competes when he looks at the bare canvas, like the sculptor does when he picks up his hammer and chisels, the way the golfer does when he's lining up that 20-foot undulating putt on a beautiful sunny morning. We compete with ourselves ultimately. To feel that the measure of us is in others, that we have to do better than the next fellow, is really allowing ourselves to be defined by others. It's not striving for what's good and honorable and the accomplishments of our abilities within our own skin. It's defining ourselves by this sense of besting our brethren. Really? I don't think that's at all what the audience here in Masonic Effects is thinking. We're looking for something deeper, and hopefully Masonic Effects will be a leg up for that. At least that's the intent. The leg up being something of permanence, something endurable within your life. At the end of days, not the conversation you have when it's a bright sunny day and you're walking down the street with your friends, but in those moments of contemplation, like now, where you can sit back with a warm cup or a big cup of your favorite beverage. It's 5 o'clock somewhere in the face of the earth, and here at Masonic Effects, we rarely are in a good position to judge. We've taken our obligations seriously, if not always able to accomplish that task, we take it seriously to judge fairly and with mercy. Who am I to say? But with your imbibe, as you imbibe, don't let that interfere with your relationships with others. Don't do it if other people are worried about you, people close to you. Don't be so selfish. I had a young Mason come up to me just a couple of weeks ago talking about how he was very brash. And he was talking about, you know, the message that he was saying was that Masonry was helpful for him to put his wife in her place. My heart sunk. Of course it sunk. So in a couple of minutes, I tried to take that conversation in a different direction. And I think I hope I was successful. The leadership, you know, if that's what a man is in a relationship, a leader rather than a partner, he can't see beyond the end of his own nose. Well, you know, that's then he needs to be shown the benefit, the depth of character that is brought to his feet, is laid at his feet by Masonic principles. Listen to a little bit of this. This is something that I think will set the tone for today. I hope so. This is Valentina Lisitsa, and she's playing Liszt's Hungarian Rhapsody number 2. Why is something of permanence? And I've lived a fairly decent life already, a long life. I'm blessed. And blessed with my health at my age, relative health, and begin to think of what's important. I don't think I want my life expressed by superficial, like a pop song. It's makes my toe tap for a few days, and then it's forgotten in the thousands of pages of other forgotten material. Thousands and thousands of songs that have been on the radio since I've grown. Maybe life, the radio is like a little bit of a history. It traces my life from the early 50s on. But to tap into music that endures was a different kind of a lesson. Makes you wonder, why do certain songs endure for hundreds of years? Why, when we hear certain phrases of music that we understand immediately what it is, why has certain music been able to affect us more deeply than others? The pop song is that small piece of melody repeated over and over with a bit of a hook. And it's not to be good music, it's to be saleable music. So, you know, for the rest of days, every time we hear a few notes of John Lennon's and the Beatles' Imagine, we're probably going to be taken to a spot, place and time, and to a good place inside of our minds, and to good memories. We just passed to the anniversary of his death. I won't mention the person that did it, because that was his point, to gain notoriety, a meager little life, by killing somebody. So he made a pretty interesting contribution to the world, sort of an everyman connection. Listen to this. This is Liszt's Hungarian Rhapsody number 2. Just a taste. Thank you. Franz Liszt. No, it's not like he was creating from a position of privilege. Don't think that. Think of being able to find something so beautiful, so penetrating, when your life is in turmoil. True turmoil. Think of what that must be like, to have that gift. Freemasonry is often misunderstood, and for good reason. Can we talk about this just for a minute? Freemasonry, it has plot, dark and affirming. It has a pulse, a rhythm of free will as ancient as a time out of time. It's forgotten. Conspiracy theorists pick up on a history complete with perception, if not facts, that define the order as a serious threat to God, to the crown and nation. We can be forgiven for many a faux pas, with perhaps one exception. The basis of classicism, I think, Masonry is a classic, and that's why it endures. It's in good company with classical art, classical music. The basis of classicism is the evolution of societies into civilizations. Civilizations evolved as agriculture replaced hunting and gathering. Marilyn Hutchison captured the idea beautifully. She said, classicism, therefore, can be understood as defining and long-lasting civilizational patterns shaped by belief systems. Belief systems include both philosophies and religions. It suggests to me that we are of a belief system of a philosophical nature. If nothing else, neither philosophy nor a religion, Freemasonry is a belief system. In that sense, it is a classic. Previously, music and theatrics had been benchmarks of our order. Antiquarians went to the depths to tell us about high expectations and lower realities and disappointments. Always we are left with the suggestion that Freemasonry was of a time before that always bests the efforts of today. It has been too long that we measured our success in volumes. When did we stop examining the quality of our work? When did our lodges become places where bonhomie replaced the exchange of ideas? The true purpose of our belief system has been covered with layers of plaster. Going into an old cathedral, an old building, Roman baths, and seeing the mosaics in behind them only by trying to repair a crack in the plaster, we see what's behind it. Freemasonry has those cracks. Until the 21st century, cracks have been appearing. Curious builders doing repairs and discovered vaults full of relics untouched in darkness that for far too long. The classics, well, they speak to us out of time. We could listen. Measuring our success in volumes is like saying we need to produce. Maybe it's like Handel's Water Music. We need to produce a new bit of music every single week. Well, he was doing it because of his benefactor, the king, who was expecting him to have a new fanfare or a new piece of music for his soirees. And so we hear a lot of the music being derivative. And he's been mocked for that. But surely to goodness, if you look at the body of his work, he was getting paid well, and he satisfied the king. in the court. And it worked. And the music, the pieces, and the phrasing has a charm all its own. When did that happen, gentlemen? That the purpose, the sharing of ideas, I think was what once brought us together. And because it happened with such regularity and it served a purpose, we thought to organize it into something. To, instead of being spontaneous, have schedules, meeting on certain days and months and years, celebrating certain things. Well, we used to have lunar lodges. Not so very long ago, the lodge that I was initiated into was a lunar lodge, but that became the older members were mocking that and had no idea. Most of them had no idea what was part of the history of the lodge. And so there's that mockishness, you know, rather shameful and embarrassing. It's as embarrassing as when you hear some wag. Have you had a wag come up to you and say, "It sucks to be you"? I know, not much in the way of manners, is it? But, you know, you smile and... The quality of the encounter was around a very important purpose. And a good time broke out when we got together to talk about things lively and important. It was not to try and, it was not complacency. It was about talking and understanding innovation. Trying to come to terms with change, and thinking about what would change in our world as a result of newness, new discoveries of old things. Our physicists find new discoveries of old things, things that have been going on around us for forever, and yet are invisible to us. It's like the dark matter. It's invisible to us, but it's been there forever until it's, quote, discovered. The great ideas that brought us together are still with us today. They can't be extinguished. A very dear friend has sons that are brilliant, great achievers, but I always think that they're a chip off the old block. He's a very modest man. But I always think that they had a great start in life, a man that encouraged their curiosity. The quality, being around people that had done something, had studied, had a qualified opinion, was interesting. And you can imagine, we would do that over dinner. Good food, good drink, good company. Bon ami. I can see, and I think we can be forgiven for a couple of hundred years, the passage of time, that men would see this process and not realize how it occurred. It didn't occur spontaneously. The knife and fork mason that we've heard about so often over the century. Didn't take anything over. It doesn't contribute to the larger discussion, but can see you can see in his eyes that this appeals to him. Camaraderie. If the quality is whether somebody has something useful to say, Freemasonry tries to make that clear. Tries to make it clear to all of us. Don't waste a person's time. Don't speak unless you have something to say. Not just because you need the opportunity to talk. You like having a whole audience of people. But saying these things is a bit ridiculous. People that already know it don't need to hear it. The people that do need to hear it are deafened to it all. Unless somebody eventually becomes frank with them and makes them stop and take on the tasks of learning to listen. Aude, vide, tace. Yeah. The quality of the experience is how Freemasonry became a classic. Now we fret. Our membership is dropping off. And we even hear people talk about how we can't compete with memberships and other social organizations. We are living in a privileged culture, and we suffer from that. We suffer a compassion fatigue, volunteer fatigue, too much of a good thing. Too many requests, and we aren't aware. We don't seem to be aware. We seem to be indifferent to the process. We just keep pushing and pushing. We get these requests and phone calls that invade our so-called privacy in the pages of newspapers and magazines that we read every time we turn on the television. Turn on the radio, pamphlets in our mailbox, and even in our lodges, almost every time. There's not just one effort to solicit our time and money. It's repeated ad nausea. And we scratch our heads and wonder why people don't come back. Well, we profess to be an organization of insight. And unless we demonstrate that in our dealings with other people, especially the new fellows coming in, if we seem loutish, thoughtless, then we are not unique. We are not expressing the quality of Freemasonry. I've heard very stern Masons talk about putting up billboards and advertising for members. My, the merchants of Masonry, let's sell it. There's no product to sell. It's ideas. So it's not something that you can impose on a man. If he has a natural ability and we can afford him access to materials that help him develop his thoughts, and then he will begin to experience the humility of dealing with great and profound idea. And it is humble. Remember, Darwin sat on his work for, if that's any measure, Darwin sat on his work for 8 years before he agreed to have it published, because he knew he would be isolated, that his colleagues would ridicule him, that he would have to bear public hostility. And he did. And who would want that? Let's put Galileo on trial. Let's put the Italian on trial. How dare he tell the world that the earth is not the center of the universe? How dare he? And we will imprison you unless you recant. The idea of being a classic, I think, is perhaps not to everybody's taste. I think not everybody can be a Mason. Not everybody's cut out for this, for being a classic. I don't mean in terms of stroking ego, wearing regalia or jewels or having ritual around us, but understanding that we're part of something larger than ourselves. We're part of a belief system. We're part of a, we've organized and we've evolved into this very uninteresting virtual civilization. We've become civilized. And Freemasonry is, if nothing else, defining and long-lasting, and has organizational patterns that have been shaped by that sense of common purpose, of universality, full of philosophical statement. Here. This was written by Aaron Copland, and it was in answer to a request from Eugene Gossens. Eugene was a conductor of the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra in response to the entry into the Second World War of the United States. They eventually got over that, what was it, isolation or xenophobia? Just always struggle with that, don't they? This is called The Fanfare for the Common Man. I think you'll like it. Classics were understated, and it goes on. Amazing piece of work. Step up. Are you ready as a Mason to step up? Don't be so timid. You can come from common root. We all do. But look at the greatness around us. Look at the achievements. Appreciate the achievements of humanity. Appreciate the result of effort. Here, you want something very interesting to think about. Here's let me see if I can find something for you. Here it is. Listen to this. This is a guy. This is, I'm going to let you hear a little piece of music by the Vienna Philharmonic. And this is conducted by a Russian maestro, Valery Grigiev. Interesting guy, very intense. Now, think about this. This is a guy who's got an orchestra of, they're genius. These are, it's... about 95 of the very best orchestral musicians in the world. Almost as many egomaniacs as there are in, well, I won't say what organization. And here it is, Grigorev must make this group play Rimsky-Korsakov's Scheherazade, not like they would play it for themselves. Oh, this is the way it's done. He hears it played in his head, and he has to get this entire orchestra of egomaniacs, who I'm the best, and they are. Can you imagine how difficult that is? Can you imagine the effort that it takes, the persuasion, the focus? Now, how close does this result come to what it took to help the process of Freemasonry congeal? Just listen to this. I'll just play a little piece of it for you. Catch this. Thank you. get the idea? Do you see what he was able to do? None of it was possible without the exceptional efforts of 95 people. None of it was possible. And what we hear, this beautiful, beautiful, enriched music, was not possible without the complete commitment of every one of the 95 to the process of the whole. A few years ago, I was studying at the University of Windsor, and during my summer, I took a violin course. I happened to have one of the most brilliant and award-winning professors of music teaching it. Who knew at the time? But it was exceptional. And I was in a group who were music students, all doing their master's. And this was their second instrument. That was part of the requirement. So we had opera singers, and we had horn players and pianists. Walking in for our rehearsals was wonderful, because a lot of the students would be practicing on their principal instrument. It was amazing passing these small study areas and hearing this beautiful music. And then as we all stepped out and picked up our violin, we were all of the same wide-eyed, innocent, confused look. And I can still remember the professor teaching us how to work as a group. And he was charming. He would raise his hands in the air, as you've seen conductors do for forever, and we were to play on the downbeat. Brings his hands down, boom. And I remember we were playing a piece of Mozart. And on the downbeat was just this a blur of notes, just this blur. Everybody was doing it their own way. And he very gently stopped and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, there is no award for being first." Everybody in the room got it. And the next time, we were watching each other. We were intently watching each other for that moment when Bo hit the string, that precise nanosecond. And believe it or not, it took practice, but when it occurred, it was absolute bliss. It was amazing that we could all, and we knew it, and he knew it, and we were doing it under his direction. We needed that downbeat. And when we knew what it was, otherwise we were thinking very selfishly. We were thinking about our fretwork and our bow position and all the rest of it. But how hard do you draw on the bow and the pressure? But when it occurred, small things. And would an audience know? My goodness. We need to be able to separate some of this business out, I would say. We don't necessarily have to make the back of the stage the front of the stage. When you go to theater, the company doesn't trot out everybody from the back that was necessary to make the performance work for us. No, it's assumed. It's assumed when we are giving a standing ovation to the leads that it's on behalf of this whole production. And the whole production, the house, is there to support the work of the diva, the star. One doesn't work without the other. This clamor, we still clamor in masonry to be first. We don't need to, brethren. Let Masonic effects be the challenge then. Put words to the challenge that you already have inside your heart. To step up. To find to recognize that we are part of something much, much larger than ourselves. Now, I won't say that there's a wrongness to any of this. We live in a world where we're often governed by habit. There's an interesting book by a fellow by the name of Charles Duhigg, and it's called The Power of Habit and Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business. And he talks very about the strength of our habits. So we can, it's not that we can be forgiven. There's no need to forgive. It's there to be understood. Once we understand it, then it becomes a tool for us. Remember, the world, as great as it is, and large as it is, and in a smaller way, I guess, our order, is still it still has the innovative power of thinkers and that culture, the progress of the culture, but it's not a uniformity. As much as we try for compliance, it's only in terms of very small, it's the compliance of that downbeat that we want to hear, that we need to hear, not a competition to be there first. Never. We are like the symphony, the ballet, the opera, the classic. Why try to roll up our sleeves and be something that we're not? As an order, we are a classic. As individuals, we're that common man. You may like country, I might like rock and roll, as the song goes. Perfectly reasonable. But we are transformed through the obligations of Freemasonry into the classic. In the world, some things don't change very much. I'm going to just read you a little bit about a place that exists to this day. And this is in Romania, in a poor and remote region of the Mara Mureș. It's up in the northern Carpathians, and it's cut off by mountain roads from the rest of Romania in the south. And the ancient body measurements exist. Remember, in days gone by, we used parts of our body as measurements. Anything approaching 2 meters, a plank of wood or a table, is a raif. And that's the span of a man's arms. You can stretch your arms out. A cot is a cubit, and that's from the elbow to fingertip. A tuath, it's about 2.5 centimeters, and it's the length of the last joint of the thumb. Mm-hmm. And a palma is a hand's breadth, the distance between the outstretched tips of the thumb and fingers of one hand. Palma. A hand's breadth, it's often referred to metaphorically as a palma de palmette. A hand's breadth of land can stand for those little patches. The slim border zones between holdings, pieces of land whose ownership is uncertain, which are also sometimes called battlegrounds. I apologize to our Romanian friends. Duc de Turanur, literally it means fighting lands. Every year in Mara Mureș, neighbors kill each other for these contested slips of territory. At times there have been 40 violent attacks in 12 months. And week after week, just like road accidents are described in other parts of the world, the local press reports another man, always a man, killed for a hand's breadth of land. After the act, the murderers usually give themselves up, shocked at what they've done, going back into their kitchens to wait for the police to arrive. And when the case comes to trial, pleading guilty, as if something had burst up within them for which they were not responsible. Our habits, our cultures, are deep-seated. Our beliefs are very powerful. But the effort to find that ability within us does not occur without effort, does not occur without mentoring. We're not these natural phenomena. Of course, in the world around us, in North America, under the influence of the me generation and that a world created around the notions that the individual with effort can prevail, it goes unchallenged, completely unchallenged, until the Occupy movement a few years ago began to reveal, pull back the curtain and see the wizard standing there. Far from it. Equality exists only in the mind. The system, the culture, has developed rules that give access to the privileged. And just as Malcolm Gladwell revealed in his work, it is much harder for somebody starting from meager grounds. And the notion that the starting point is to come here with nothing, to this country with nothing, and build yourself up, it is about opportunity. Well, you're thinking that the people that come here have no drive, no skills. That's just probably the most ethnocentric thing that we could even imagine. Of course, it's an honor, I think, and a reflection of life here in this country that we can appeal to some of the very best around the world. And I'd like to think that you and I are part of that group at one point in time, where our ancestors came here, perhaps courageous, perhaps out of a lack of choice, clearances, or famine, or war, to become part of something audacious. And if nothing else, Freemasonry is that. This notion of universality seems to be off the table when we can smell blood. We want to go and draw revenge wherever we can, justifying wars, only to have it end and be able to look up from the carnage and truly begin to ask ourselves the point. Time is very, very harsh to our civilizations. We want and need to make progress. So doing the same things habitually is not going to help us. We're still going to be killing our neighbor over a palm's width of land. Freemasonry is that opportunity. Before I go, I want to give you just a little taste of something quite beautiful. This is from poems that make grown men cry. This is Simon McBurney, and he's reading a passage, an extract from Our Faces, My Heart, Brief as Photos.
I'm going to read an extract from John Berger's book, And Our Faces, My Heart, Grief as Photos. And it's the one piece in the book which is not actually a poem, because it was written in prose. So I suppose one of the things that John Berger says in his book is that poems, even when narrative, are not like stories. Stories are all about battles of one sort or another, which end in victory and defeat, whereas poems cross the battlefield, listening to the cries of the triumphant and fearful, and they bring a kind of peace. In other words, they listen. And I have always felt with this particular feeling is that the word with this particular piece is that the words are listening. It joins and the act of listening joins, just as love joins. Love's opposite is separation, and death separates eternally. It's an unbridgeable gap that we constantly yearn to close as we pledge to love eternally. And my father was an archaeologist, but he thought of himself very much as a scientist. He knew about bridging gaps. There were bones he dug which were more fragile than the earth that surrounded them. Shards of flint were reassembled to reveal the hands that napped them. He uncovered, analyzed, reassembled artifacts, suggesting conjunctions that revealed the truth about our past and joined us with it. And this is what Berger does. He also joins, but his tools are words. And in this exquisite book, he uses the tools, I think, to dig like an archaeologist and distill like a chemist or theorize like a cosmologist, and joins the fragments he uncovers with an eye as sure as an astronomer and a hand as gentle as a carpenter. In this poem written in prose, he does something extraordinary. He joins love, and for me, he joins it with his enemy, separation. He constructs a promise. A promise that is perhaps indistinguishable from the promise of poetry itself. A promise, as Berger puts it, that language has acknowledged, has given shelter to the experience which demanded, which cried out. My Jack, what reconciles me to my own death more than anything else is the image of a place. A place where your bones and mine are buried, thrown, uncovered, together. They're strewn there pell-mell. One of your ribs leans against my skull. A metacarpal of my left hand lies inside your pelvis. Against my broken ribs, your breast, like a flower. The 100 bones of our feet are scattered like gravel. It is strange that this image of our proximity, concerning as it does mere phosphate of calcium, should bestow a sense of peace. Yet it does. With you, I can imagine a place where to be phosphate of calcium is enough.
Simple words. Hey, we're only a few days away from a holiday. Brethren, I hope you've enjoyed the show. Thank you so much for your support. It's truly amazing. If we've done something useful to contribute to the discussion in your own mind, then good. Reach out. If you'd like to be part of the program, if you'd like to comment, I'm going to be doing a series of In Conversation, and you can reach me to talk about the to let me know what topic you'd like to review at Masonic Effects, all one word, at gmail.com. Thank you so very much for your attention, your contribution to the discussion today. I think we've solved great things. And now for a good meal. I've enjoyed the camaraderie so far. I look forward to being in touch with you all real soon. Merry Christmas. Thank you. good. Thank you.
Beating strong in